Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us on this very cold day for today's presentation by Chloe Angel, journalist and editor who will speak to us today on an Australian's perspective on U.S. politics. I'm Janet Linus, the ICFRC board member and host for today's program. We would like to take a moment to thank our members, our volunteers, and interns for making these forums possible. I want to acknowledge also our university and community sponsors and supporters, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, the University of Iowa International Programs, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. And I also thank today's special sponsors, Joyce Carmen Baldus and Conrad Schultz. I also thank City Channel 4 for professionally recording our programs for Cablecast. Ah, I can hear it now. On City Channel 4 and 118-2 and U of I Libraries Digital Archives. Please be sure if you are on Facebook to like City Channel 4. Today's format will be the same as usual. Following our speaker's presentation at about 1 p.m., we will have a 15-minute question and answer period with written questions that will be submitted by our audience members. And please note that we request questions be submitted in writing because questions from the floor cannot be picked up by City Channel 4, and we want to make sure that they are preserved for later podcast. You can write your questions on the cards that are at your table, and at the end of the speaker's remarks, you can hold them up on our interns will come around and collect them. I will remind you, as well as myself, if you would silence your cell phones and other electronic devices at this time, we would much appreciate that. And I also ask that if you must leave early, please do so quietly without disturbing others. Now, at this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Chloe Angel. Please join me in welcoming her. She is a journalist from Sydney, Australia, living in the Iowa City area and facing her second winter here with probably more trepidation because of last year's winter. She's currently a contributing editor at marieclaire.com. Prior to January of 2019, Angel was the founding deputy opinion editor at HuffPost.com. Before launching the opinion section, she spent 2 years as HuffPost's senior front page editor. During her time working at HuffPost, Angel covered a variety of topics from politics to popular opinions to classical ballet, as well as working on the 2016 Olympic gymnastics coverage. Angel has her pieces published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, the Guardian, New York Magazine, Reuters, and the New Republic. Until 2014, Angel was a senior columnist at Feministing, the world's most read feminist publication. Currently, Angel is a facilitator and senior fellowship leader at the Op-Ed Project, a social venture founded to increase the range of voices and quality of ideas we hear in the world. Through the Op-Ed Project, she has taught at Yale, Columbia, Dartmouth, Cornell, and Emory universities. Angel has a PhD in arts and media from the University of New South Wales and a BA in sociology from Princeton University. So please join me in welcoming Chloe Angel. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you to Janet and Bill. Ooh, mood lighting. And to the rest of the ICFRC team for having me. I'd also especially like to thank the interns and volunteers who make days like this happen. They give up their time to perform valuable and admirable public service. So can we just give them a round of applause before we start? Thank you. So I've been asked to speak today about what it's like for an Australian journalist to cover American politics. And today, my answer is cold. It's cold. And it looks even colder when you're looking at it from my point of view, because your 3 degrees is my minus 16 degrees. It's not fun to wake up and see that on your temperature app. So I want to start us off today with a quick pop quiz. And if there are any Australians in the room, I would ask them to exempt themselves from this little bit of trivia. Can anyone tell me who the current Australian Prime Minister is? Any guesses? Morrison? Who said Morrison? Close. Oh, that's just a mashup of the previous two. That's close. His name is Scott Morrison. Scott Morrison, affectionately known where I come from as ScoMo, because Australians never met a name that they couldn't turn into a nickname. To up the ante a little bit, can anyone tell me who the previous, let's say, five prime ministers were? And this isn't really fair because there's been a lot of turnover at the top in the last decade, but I want to try this anyway. Anyone? Any Australians want to volunteer? Malcolm Turnbull is one. Yep. Any others? There was a woman. Yes, well remembered. Does anyone remember what the woman's name was? All right, I'm going to put you out of your misery. So here we have them in ascending order, starting in 2007, we have Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard, Kevin Rudd again, Tony Abbott, and Malcolm Turnbull, or Malcolm Morrison, which is what I'm going to call him in my head from now on. So if I were to address a comparable group of Australians and administer the same test, but with American presidents, my guess is that about 90% of them would ace that test. And simply put, that is what it means to be a superpower. It means that your domestic affairs don't stay domestic. They don't even stay regional, right? It means that your front page news is also everyone else's front page news. And I'm going to say more on that later. But before I do that, I want to tell you a little bit about myself that you didn't hear in my professional bio. So I grew up in Sydney, Australia, which is one of our largest cities, with an Australian dad and an American mum. They met here in the States and they moved to Australia shortly before I was born. So my sister and I are both dual US-Australian citizens. And when I was 15, my sister left to go to university in the US. And that was when I started paying more attention to American politics. And that was partly a function of my age. I was 15. I was forming a political awareness and identity for the first time. And it was partly because Australia had just joined the Coalition of the Willing, despite massive protests against involvement in the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was also because my sister, now that she was living here, was consuming American political satire like The Daily Show and would tell me all about it when she came home. And where big sisters go, little sisters tend to follow. So by 12th grade, or year 12, as we call it, this was my dream Saturday night when I wasn't babysitting. Skip the parties, order a pizza, stay home and watch Saturday Night Live from the previous Saturday, because the time difference meant that it wasn't even Saturday night in New York yet, be in bed by 11. I was very cool in high school. And because that was my introduction to American politics, satire, and pop culture, my understanding was that politics here was just more interesting, more entertaining than Australian politics. Now, these days, I recognize that boring politics is a really good thing. Like, wouldn't we kill for some slow news days and some boring politics right about now? No news, or dull news, I have come to learn, is good news. And in fact, at home, when someone describes a candidate or a politician as running an American-style campaign, that is not a compliment. But at the time, I was so drawn to American politics because it just seemed more glossy and theatrical, and that appeal was part of what convinced me to follow my sister's lead and apply to universities here. So in 2005, I moved to the States, and I've been here for the last 14 years and here in Iowa for the last year and change. And I want to tell you one story to illustrate what kind of a culture shock that move was from Australia to the East Coast here. In the fall of my freshman year, One of the first classes I took was a small freshman seminar in the sociology department. It was called Divisions in Red and Blue, Cultural Schisms in American Society. So this was 2005, and the concept of the U.S. as a nation split into red states and blue states was at this point thoroughly entrenched. And there were about 15 students in this class, and we'd had to apply. And my understanding is that we had been chosen from the pool of applicants to get a good geographical spread from across the country. And I was the only international student. About halfway through the semester, I had a pretty good handle on where my fellow students sat on the political spectrum. I knew who the liberals were. I knew who the soon-to-be liberals were. That's a fun joke about the effect of liberal arts education. And at one point, one of the young, still Republicans, was talking about the problem with big government, right? Big government this, big government that. I don't really recall the details. What I do recall is that one of the women who at this point I knew to be fairly liberal raised her hand and interjected and said, well, obviously, no one wants a big government. And then I raised my hand and said, sorry, what's the problem with big government? And 15 sets of eyes just swiveled towards me and stared at me like I had said something truly alien, like I was truly alien. And that was the moment when I realized that for all of our similarities in language and in culture, and for all the time I had spent familiarizing myself with American politics and the satirical industrial complex that had what was growing up around it, there were some deeply embedded differences in attitude and national identity that were going to take a long time and a lot of exploration for me to fully understand. Because as familiar as the U.S. felt, because of my family and because of my weird, uncool high school passions, I was still very much a stranger in a strange land. And what I want to talk about today is how useful that feeling has been for me as a journalist covering another country's politics, this sense that there are deep underlying assumptions, beliefs, and narratives, this stories that a nation tells itself about itself, that if you didn't grow up as part of that nation, you can actually do a fairly good job of identifying those beliefs, understanding them, and explaining them back to the people who do hold them. So for the last 10 years, since I graduated from college, I've been covering American politics and, as Janet mentioned, also popular culture. And I want to focus today on two topics that I've covered, both fairly uncontroversial and undivisive, and those are abortion and gun violence. So this should be a barrel of laughs for everyone involved. Let's start with abortion. It probably seems laughably obvious to say this, but it's worth saying out loud because people often take it for granted when they grow up with it. In the US, reproductive rights and abortion rights in particular are highly politicized, deeply partisan, and thus get a lot of news coverage. When I moved here, I was shocked to discover this. Mostly I was confused to discover this because I was coming from a place where abortion is not a wedge issue. It's not a single issue for many voters, and it gets very little media attention. It is simply a fact of life, divorced from partisan politics, and very infrequently covered by the press, unless there's a policy change, which doesn't happen that often because in Australian politics, one of the two major parties isn't constantly trying to limit abortion access. And I remember being genuinely taken aback by the pitch of America's abortion debate, by how normal it was and still is for people who are opposed to abortion to throw around words like murder and slavery. And the weekend that I graduated from college, having just made the decision to stay in the US and try and do journalism here instead of going home, an anti-abortion extremist walked into a church and shot an abortion provider in the head. And it was hard not to draw a connection between that act of violence and the fact that anti-abortion commentators had spent years describing that provider as a baby killer and a murderer. So I've been covering reproductive rights for several years now, including some on the ground and in the exam room reporting at two of the remaining abortion clinics in Alabama. That's what this story was. This is one of the two remaining clinics in Alabama. And this is the woman who has been running it since the 1970s. And the story that I wrote was about how incredibly difficult it is to offload that kind of a property with that kind of liability, with a faux clinic, a crisis pregnancy center operating right next door. The business model is a very tough one. And there are also people who know that they have to make that business model work so they can provide essential healthcare services to the community. So I went down to Birmingham, Alabama, and reported this story. And I focused on that opposition to abortion because it's what makes the American experience of reproductive healthcare so different to the Australian one. This clinic, like a lot of other ones, has hordes of protesters harassing patients outside clinics. Outside the clinic, in Alabama, there is a state-mandated script for doctors that contradicts what the science actually says. And swirling around all of that is this deeply rooted belief that non-procreative sex is something shameful that should be discouraged and punished, especially in women. And it is profoundly strange for me to think back on that classroom conversation that fall of my freshman year and my discovery for the American disdain for big government when I'm sitting in a clinic listening to a doctor deliver one of those scripts. Or when I'm listening to a woman talk about how she had to pay to bury her fetal remains after she had an abortion, whether she wanted to pay for that or not because the state required it of her. I would also be remiss if I didn't talk about what it's like to do this kind of journalism, what it's like to cover a barrel of laughs, fun, and completely uncontroversial topic like this, especially given the pitch of the debate and the often violent opposition to what the work that women, people like Gloria do. It is really scary. In the course of my work, I've received death threats, I've received rape threats, I've had to call the police and the FBI on multiple occasions. I've been filmed and photographed while on the job against my consent and against my expressed wishes. I've received physical hate mail, rarely, and digital hate mail on an almost daily basis. It is frightening, it is destabilizing, and it takes a real mental and emotional toll on journalists who do this work. And it can also mean that there are stories that don't get written for fear of the reaction that they might provoke and the danger that they might put the journalist or the subjects in. And it sort of feels like conceding defeat to say that out loud. It feels like giving up the glamorous mantle of fearless journalist pursuing stories that matter no matter the consequences. But it's the truth. Because of the current animosity towards the press, particularly around already radioactive issues like this one, there will be important stories that go unreported and unwritten, which is, of course, the point of threatening journalists in the first place. On that same reporting trip, I visited the second clinic that is still operating in Huntsville, Alabama. These are two anti-abortion protesters. They and their colleagues filmed me the entire time that I was out doing reporting on what was happening in that clinic without my consent, against my express wishes. One of them live streamed the entire time without my knowledge. Doing journalism in these situations is very stressful, and I'm pretty sure that my name is now on a list of journalists somewhere who are to be tracked and looked for if they ever come back into the state of Alabama. And I think it's important to note that this was all true before we had a president who encourages suspicion of and violence toward the press. The current administration has certainly made matters worse. And regardless of what happens in the 2020 election, that animosity that he has unleashed is going to be it's going to take a very long time to put back in the box, if indeed we ever can. But that animosity was there before. And I know because I experienced it well before the 2016 campaign. It was in my inbox, in my Twitter feed every single day. And it's true that his campaign and his presidency created a sort of permission structure for people to express and act on that animosity in ways that we haven't seen before. But well before 2016, I was trying to square the story that America tells itself, a story about valuing freedom of the press, with what my colleagues and I were experiencing on a daily basis. And like I said, one of the gifts of being a foreign journalist, although that term is a bit of a stretch when it's applied to me, it's sometimes easier for me to see the gaps between those assumptions and beliefs and narratives that a nation has about itself and the reality of living in that nation. And I consider it part of my work to make those gaps visible and to consider how we might close them. I'm going to pivot to a more enjoyable topic now, and that's gun violence. So get ready. Now, I know most of you are old enough to remember a time before mass shootings in schools and churches and movie theaters and festivals and concerts and big box stores and nightclubs were the norm. Daily news, wallpaper. But I am not. One of my earliest political memories is tied to a mass shooting and to the political response to it. And in fact, it's tied to the mass shooting that Americans talk about every time they want to make the case that we could buy back or confiscate some of the 390 million guns that are owned by Americans today. In 1996, when I was 8 years old, a young man in the island state of Tasmania picked up a Colt AR-15 and shot 35 people. It shocked the conscience of the nation, and it became a catalyst for the conservative Prime Minister John Howard to push through a gun ban and a buyback scheme that required every ounce of political capital that he had and threatened to end his relatively new tenure as Prime Minister. It didn't in the end. And while Australia has seen other smaller mass shootings since, we haven't seen anything on that scale ever again. So just as there is an entire population of American kids who are growing up experiencing the threat of school shootings and the trauma of active shooter drills, there is an entire generation of Australians who grew up without that threat, with a mass shooting as an early memory and nothing more. And as a result, Australia's successful buyback has come to represent something of a panacea that's put forward every time there is another mass shooting in America. And there have been at least 21 this year. Australia did it, and we can too. That's the refrain. And it's one I try to complicate every time I hear it, because every time I hear it, I think back again to that freshman year classroom conversation. Big government. So when I say that refrain happens over and over again, it happens in the pages of the New York Times. This is an op-ed by John Howard, the then former Prime Minister, written in 2013 in response to, I honestly don't remember which mass shooting. It's a blur. But this is the refrain, right? Australia did this and America can do it too. And if you watch the coverage of mass shootings, a week later, there will be some version of this argument made in print, made on television, sometimes even made on the campaign trail. And to understand why that refrain is so inadequate, it's important to understand the difference between how Australians think about government and politicians and how Americans do. And generally speaking, Australians are suspicious of politicians, but not of government. We enjoy single-payer healthcare, or as it's called here, socialized medicine. Our public schools are funded at the state level and not by local property taxes. And crucially, we didn't win our independence through armed conflict. We don't love government, but we don't have a deep cultural attachment to the idea that the less we have of it, the better. We certainly don't have a history of overthrowing it with the help of firearms. And at the same time, Australians generally don't think that much of politicians. We do not expect to fall in love with the people that we elect. We do not expect to be gripped by their oratory. We hire them to do a job, and we expect them to do it well. Contrast that to the American suspicion of government, but emotional attachment to individual politicians as people. As Iowans, I know you all understand this intuitively, because the expectation that you fall in love with a candidate arrives on your doorstep every 4 years. Contrast that, and you can start to see why an Australian solution probably won't be sufficient to solve the uniquely American problem of mass shootings specifically, and of widespread gun ownership more generally. And it's not my intention to convey a lack of Australian patriotism or pride in what Australia did, or a lack of urgency for America's problem, because it is one that horrifies me and so many other people. My intention is simply to question the Australian method as a panacea for a sickness that began to reveal itself that day in the fall of my freshman year. I'd also like to say a few words about what it's like to cover mass shootings in America. And I should start by saying that I haven't covered them on the ground the way that I've reported on abortion access, my experience of covering mass shootings has been from the physical and emotional remove of a newsroom that is many hundreds of miles away. But that kind of coverage takes a toll as well. In the fall of 2015, I joined HuffPost as a front page editor, which is a job that I can best describe as half air traffic controller, half department store window dresser. And I'll explain what I mean by that. When you're a front page editor at a news website, your job is to track all of the stories that are breaking and developing, make sure a reporter is assigned to cover each one of them, and make sure you beat all the other outlets to be the first to send out that breaking news alert to people's phones. That's the air traffic control part of it. The window dressing part is that your job is to make sure that the headlines and images that appear on the front page, so yahoonews.com or wallstreetjournal.com, are appealing and kept up to date with developments in each story. I started at HuffPost the fall of 2015, and 9 days later, I covered my first mass shooting, and I distinctly remember my supervisor saying, "Huh, I'm surprised it took this long." Then he said, "I'm sure it'll be the last one," and then he walked away. That shooting was at Umpqua Community College in Washington State. 10 people were killed and 8 were injured, and the process of covering that event unfolded in a sequence that I would come to memorize, and that after 3 years I could carry out almost without thinking about it. And here's how that process goes. People on or near the scene tweet about an active shooter. That's usually how it starts. You quickly assign one person to watch the developments on Twitter or on the police scanner, and another person to write up a bare bones outline of what we know, where it happened, how many people are suspected injured or dead. You assess whether or not you need to put a third reporter on a plane to go down and report on the ground. And that's usually determined by how bad it looks, how high it looks like the casualty and death toll is going to be. You send out a news alert to people's phones with as much information as you can confirm. You assign someone to watch for the inevitable thoughts and prayers tweets from politicians and other leaders and write a story about those. You assign another person to write a post about the victims. And sometimes if the death count is particularly high, that story takes more than one writer. When we covered the Bataclan shootings in Paris at the end of 2015, the victims post was, I think we had about 6 people, different people assigned to writing the story about the victims, because there were just so many people to profile. So it only took 9 days on the job for me to start learning this routine, and I carried it out so many times in the next few years that, like I said, I could almost do it without thinking. And in fact, I kind of had to do it without thinking, because stopping to think about it too hard made me want to cry and scream and throw up and give up on everything. And the mental and emotional toll of doing that kind of work, even from the remove of a newsroom, to say nothing of doing it on the ground and going to talk to victims' families, is real. It is documented. And there are, thankfully, trauma resources for journalists who do that kind of work. But it's the reason I stepped away from doing breaking news after a few years. Too many mass shootings, too much numbness for me to feel like I could hold on to my mental health and my humanity on the job. And I'm certainly not alone in that feeling. So this is what it's like to cover American politics as an Australian. It's the knowledge that there is another way to live, whether you're trying to get access to abortion or trying to prevent school shootings. There is another way to structure a culture that looks very similar on the surface, but that is different and better in profound ways. And it also means knowing that what works in one place probably wouldn't work in another, but believing that something might, because you've lived it. It doesn't have to be like this. We don't need to be armed to the teeth to the point where parents are scared of sending their kids to school. We don't need to proclaim ourselves suspicious of big government while also interfering in the private medical decisions of women and their families. Our journalists don't simultaneously need to be traumatized and reviled while they try to do public service in a time of shrinking salaries and mass layoffs. We do not need to spend 2 years and billions of dollars to elect a new leader every 4 years. In Australia, does anyone know how long a federal election lasts? 8 to 10 weeks. And that's a long one, and people complain about, oh, it's so grueling. It doesn't need to be like this. The roots of these problems go far deeper than I ever could have imagined that day in my freshman year. And having grown up, but they are a choice. And I had grown up somewhere where that reveals them to be a choice and reveals other choices to be possible. And this is not to say that Australia has it all figured out. Far from it. The place I come from has a deep-seated culture of white supremacy and sexism that would and does feel very familiar to visiting Americans, especially Americans of color. The legacy of genocide and cultural annihilation of our Indigenous peoples is one that we are still reckoning with very mixed results. And we have a long-standing distrust of immigrants, which has expressed itself in shocking treatment of asylum seekers in the last 20 years in particular. And before Rupert Murdoch took over American media, well, he took over ours first. So our way of doing things is far from perfect. And I certainly don't mean to stand here and pretend that it is. But one thing that I bring to my work every day is the knowledge that there are other ways to live. And I try to convey that to American readers who might take it for granted that this way is the only way. I mentioned earlier that America's status as a geopolitical and cultural superpower means that what happens here doesn't stay here. And that is true. Every time I go home, which I did last month, I get on the plane and think, oh, at last, I can take a break from talking about American politics. And then I get home, and the first thing anyone I meet says to me is, okay, let's talk about American politics. And given what I told you about how I grew up, you know that this was the case well before this administration. America's issues have been the world's issues for a long time. And that superpower status is the reason that a weird, uncool 16-year-old kid in Sydney could spend her Saturday nights watching SNL in the time before YouTube, because SNL was on Australian TV. Ever seen any Australian political satire? It's really good. Half the jokes would probably miss you, but it's really good. That superpower status is the reason why my Australian political awakening is tied to an American war and Australia's involvement in it. And it's the reason why On this most recent trip, Australians were very interested in hearing about what the trade war has meant for Iowan farmers specifically, because it's affecting Australian farmers as well. And to my earlier point about Australian politicians running American-style campaigns, by which I mean glossy, made for TV, designed to make you care about a candidate more than you care about the job they'll do, that's happening more and more at home. And there are even some signs that the American way of waging a cultural war debate like the abortion debate, resorting to politicized and dehumanizing language and using religion to drive a wedge into a political culture that has been largely secular for decades, is taking hold in Australia, and it's getting results. What happens here doesn't stay here. So if it feels like I've thrown a lot of information and ideas at you today, well, that's kind of a good approximation of what it feels like to be doing journalism in America today, whether you are Australian or not. It is a precarious time. It can often feel dangerous, and God knows we're no one's favorite people. Last year, a Gallup poll showed that only 23% of Americans trust newspapers a lot, and that number drops to 20% for television shows. The only institution that ranks lower than that is Congress. Gotta beat someone. And at the same time, there are so many huge, important stories worth covering that lots of us feel a sense of obligation and duty to the public to cover. And for me, understanding those stories means doing extra sociological work. It means uncovering the assumptions and the beliefs and the narratives that a people can tell themselves about themselves, and then reflecting those stories back to people who take them for granted. Thank you.
At this point, we would ask you to hold up your questions, if you would, for our interns to collect those and our volunteers. In a moment, we'll begin the question and answer period. I want to remind you about a couple of upcoming programs, and I think the cards you have on your table may have some, one that was canceled and another earlier one, but the next coming next programs coming up in the next few weeks are next Tuesday on November 19th. Boju, an associate professor at Jilin University, will be speaking on China's foreign policy and Northeast Asia, interests and challenges. And then on Wednesday, December 4th, Claire Fox, professor and chair of the English department at the University of Iowa, will be speaking on small town hospitality in the Latinx Midwest, migration, culture, and activism. So, do we have some? Okay, so our first question is, after Australia's firearms laws reduced mass shootings, was there a reduction in other forms of armed violence?
Way to lighten the mood, whoever asked that. Yes, the good news is yes, there was a massive drop in suicides, especially, particularly for young men. And as we know here in the States, that is a segment of society that is disproportionately likely to attempt suicide and to use firearms to do it. So yes, I don't quote me on this, but I believe it was roughly a 25% decrease in suicides by firearm.
I think this is kind of a follow-up. It says, number one, schools are one of the safest places for children to be. Two, mass shootings account for only a tiny fraction of our deaths. And the question is, are journalists doing their jobs?
Sounds like whoever asked that thinks they already know the answer to that question. Are journalists doing their jobs? Yes. Next.
Good. So how do Trump supporters convince themselves to support as told to support whatever, I think, as told to an Aussie journalist? How do they convince themselves to support? I think it's whatever it is. So how do Trump supporters convince themselves to support whatever he's saying, as it's told to an Australian journalist?
Oh, yeah.
Does the person who asked this question want to? Are the questions usually asked anonymously, or I want to make sure I understand the question. I haven't covered a ton of Trump supporters. I'm doing Democratic caucus coverage at the moment, so I'm talking to a lot of Democratic voters, and I haven't done campaign coverage, with the exception of this campaign. So I actually cannot speak to that, and I'm not going to try.
That seems fair. Okay. Could you talk about the narratives Iowans in particular tell ourselves about ourselves? Are Iowans unique compared to elsewhere in the U.S. and how?
Yeah. Oh, boy, can I. Well, first I want to tell you a story about the first Thanksgiving that I spent in Iowa, which was 2015. I was in the newsroom in New York, and someone said, "Hey, what are your Thanksgiving plans?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to Iowa." And I believe the response was something like, "Ugh, are you being punished for something?" And I have to tell you, I grew up with a very New York-centric view of the U.S. because that's where my mom is from. It's where I visited most as a child. It's where my American family still lives. And then I spent the first 13 years of my time in the U.S. on the East Coast. And one thing that you absorb by watching or consuming American pop culture abroad and then moving to the East Coast is this sort of generalized, culturally acceptable disdain for the middle of the country. And I'm willing to confess that that's not something that I really noticed or cared about until I fell in love with an Iowan and until I started visiting Iowa. And that's when I started to notice the sort of daily wallpaper-ish, like, "Ugh, are you being punished? That's why you have to go to Iowa?" That is just in the water in a lot of American mass culture. And obviously I notice it a lot more now because there's nothing like the zeal of a convert, right? and I try really hard to balance my delight in being here and how warm and kind and welcoming people have been here and how genuinely happy I am to live here with what feels like maybe overdoing it as a convert just a little bit. So I try and reel that in. I mean, I think the story that Iowans tell themselves about themselves is that they are nice and warm and welcoming. And in my experience, that has absolutely been true. But I'm also aware that part of that experience is filtered through the fact that I am a liberal person who moved to a liberal place, that I am white, that I am straight, that I am privileged in lots of other ways. And my suspicion is that my experience would have been very different if I were moving through Iowa, either in a different part of Iowa or in a different body. My experience would be very different. So I think the story that Iowans tell themselves about themselves is that they are nice and warm and welcoming to everyone. And my observation, if not my experience, has been that that is not always true. And that's not unique to Iowa. That's true of lots of places. But I think that's a sort of a crinkle in the narrative that doesn't always get acknowledged. I will now flee the state of Iowa.
No, we're claiming you as our own. You have to stay now.
We'll see.
Okay. I'm not sure about this. It says comment on current fire problems. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's what happens when you have a government that doesn't believe in climate change. One thing that used to happen every year when I was growing up, and I lived in Australia till I was 17, one thing that used to happen is that my grandmother, who is a New Yorker, would call me call every summer and say, I saw on CNN, Australia's on fire. And this is like the one time of the year that the rest of the world remembers that Australia exists. We're actually there the whole time. And we would always say, yeah, yeah, it happens every summer. There are always bushfires in Australia. And in fact, sort of like the Iowan Prairie, a lot of Australia's landscape is designed to burn and to regenerate. And that becomes a problem when you build houses on land that is designed to burn and regenerate. This year is different. This year, starting about 6 or 8 weeks ago, fire season started, which is considerably earlier than it usually does. And as of this week, the state of New South Wales, which is where Sydney is, initiated a new fire danger rating, the catastrophic warning. It's sort of like in summertime here when they just invent a new color on the heat map. That's what that's like. The catastrophic warning means that people will die, and three people died over the weekend. And there's going to be tremendous loss of property and of wildlife habitat. And the real risk to the risk to Sydney, which is a city built on a harbour, and built around beaches. Is embers that fly up to 30 kilometers, which is, oh God, someone help me do some quick math in my head. 20 miles. We'll call it 20 miles. That can carry on the wind and plant itself in a roof of a house that's, you know, that ought to be protected. And obviously it comes with all the same environmental risks of, you know, smog in Delhi last week, massive risks for people with asthma and other respiratory conditions. And it also serves as a really powerful symbol of what climate destruction looks like. There is nothing like things literally being on fire to make people feel like the world is ending. Guys, this has been a really fun afternoon. I hope you all feel as jazzed and energized and optimistic as I do. Are there more questions?
Hoping for a fun one.
Okay, I think this is that one. What brought you to Iowa?
I was punished, as previously established. No, I fell in love. I fell in love with an Iowan, and after 4 years of long distance dating, decided that I wanted to stop giving all of my money to Delta Airlines, and moved here.
Is there a focus to your current reporting? And I would also like to ask you, having talked to you before this, about what works you're currently working on, not just reporting, but other things.
Sure. Thanks. Right now I'm reporting on the caucuses from Iowa for the first time. One of the reasons why it was convenient to fall in love with an Iowan is that your early primaries, your early caucuses are obviously really important. It's like the one time every 4 years that people remember that Iowa exists. It's very Australian in a way. And I'm grateful every day that I didn't fall in love with someone from Idaho or Illinois, because their primaries don't mean anything. So it was a real relief to be able to move here and keep doing political journalism. So right now I'm reporting on the caucuses for Marie Claire, the women's magazine. And my editors and I are particularly interested in what campaigns look like and what the field looks like when you have an unprecedented number of women running for president. So that's what I've been working on recently. And there are, how many days left until the caucuses? How much longer do we have to endure this? It's about 3 months left. I've got about 3 months left. And obviously the pace of things picks up, and then the circus leaves town for a little while, and then it'll be back after the conventions in the summertime. When I'm not doing that, I am writing a book about ballet, which is about as far removed from political journalism as you might imagine that it's far removed from political journalism, and that's partly by design. I needed some break from a news cycle that moves really, really fast. So I decided to write about a 400-year-old glacially changing institution. But I grew up dancing and danced all through college. And I'm really interested in the way that the 400-year-old, very traditional, entrenched institution of classical ballet is either going to adapt to a modern culture or it's going to die. I'm not going to leave it on that note. I'm going to talk about something fun. So I get to spend my days talking to ballerinas and choreographers and ballet teachers and their students and parents who are trying to do a good job raising strong girls and trying to make good decisions about how they raise their daughters. So that is what I'm working on at the moment.
At this point in time, though, I want to thank Chloe Angel for her wonderful presentation and great job answering questions, even though some were depressing. So thank you. I also want to thank our sponsors, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their generous support. And we also thank today's special sponsors, Joyce Carmen Baldus and Conrad Schultz. And we thank City Channel 4 for making our programs viewable to the public. And Chloe, at this point... Thank you. Oh, I was worried there. Okay, at this point, I would like to present you with our highly coveted, hence I was worried about where it was, the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council mug, and thank you so much for your presentation. Thank you.